to you?
Milton had no interest in revealing too much to a man he had only just met.
We have history. It goes back a long way.
Why are you in here?
I'm still trying to work that out.
But you didn't kill the girl like they say you did.
No. He said, I think they drugged me. Fitz set me up.
Milton swallowed a mouthful of water, tasting his own blood as it went down. You must be careful here, Isco said. The other men notice you because you are English. Maybe they find out what they say you did. Men who kill women do not last long in a place like this. Or maybe they find out that Mr. Fitz is your enemy and they want to make him their friend, you understand?
I don't think I need to worry about that, Milton said. Fitz wants to keep me around for a while yet. I'm going to be punished before he gets rid of me.
I just say be careful. This is not a safe place, especially not for you.
You should be careful too, Milton said. If he finds out you're helping me, it might not go down well.
Isco smiled, revealing a mouth full of snaggled and tar-blackened teeth. I am an old man, John. I have been here most of my life. I will never leave. What are they going to do to me?
Milton raised a hand to his face and prodded at it. Each press and poke was rewarded with a shot of pain. How do I look?
Like you have been hit by a truck? Have you eaten?
No, Milton said. Not since breakfast.
Here.
Isco handed Milton a package wrapped in paper. He opened it and looked down at a handful of dried sardines.
It is dried in the sun and then dipped in vinegar.
He took a mouthful. His jaw ached every time he tried to chew, and the food was cold and unpleasant. But he was hungry, and he knew that he would need to maintain his strength if he was going to survive. He finished the fish, screwed up the paper, and put it down on the floor. Thank you. Isco held up his hands.
You are welcome. Now you should sleep. I show you around properly tomorrow.
Chapter 34. It took Josie 2 hours to finalize the paperwork that set out the case against John Smith. The procedure was straightforward enough. Smith would be brought to the courthouse and given the opportunity to plead guilty or not guilty to the murder charge that would be laid against him. In the event that he pleaded not guilty, he would have a minimum of 15 days to prepare for trial, and then the trial would begin 30 days after he received the pre-trial order. The president had made it a campaign pledge to improve the efficiencies of the legal process. One way was to reduce the number of suspects who ever made it as far as trial. The trail of bodies in the streets, a testament to how diligently that course of action had been pursued. The other way was to ensure that the courts ran smoothly, dispensing verdicts and shuttling the guilty into custody without delay. Josie's evidence made it obvious that this was a simple case and that Smith's culpability was clear. She had no doubt that the case would be brought against him and that he would be found guilty and sentenced to life behind bars before the end of the month. Yet, as she studied the photographs that had been emailed to her by the crime scene techs, she couldn't dispel the doubts that had been nagging her ever since she had started investigating the events of the previous day. The death of the bar owner, the burglary at the guest house, and the unexplained transfer of Smith from Quezon City to Bilibid. Josie spread the photographs out on her desk. The evidence was strong. Smith had no answers to rebut the case against him. She knew, though, that he had been holding something back during their conversation. That was his choice, but it left her with no alternative but to make the case against him. She collected the photographs. She slid them into their plastic sheath and clipped them into the ring binder that she would send to the prosecutor's office tomorrow. Josie looked at her watch. It was 8. Damn. She had completely forgotten that she had promised her mother that she would be home in time to put Angelo to bed. She would need to call her so that she could tell her that she was going to be late again.
She took her phone out of her pocket and saw that she had voicemail. She remembered the two calls that she had ignored on her way down to Bilibid. The phone was very nearly out of juice. There was just one message. She played it.
Hello. This is a message for Officer Hernandez. This is Mr. Santos from the guest house in Malate. I forgot. We have a Wi-Fi backup for all of our data. It's in the other room. The murder, the burglary, it's made such a mess of things it completely slipped my mind. My wife insisted on it. I feel foolish for not telling you. I checked it today and it's all there. The footage you wanted. I think you need to see it. I'm no expert, but it looks like it's important. So, I don't know. Call me back, please. I'll call the station. Maybe you're there. Goodbye.
Chapter 35. She saw the plume of smoke from miles away. At first, she thought it must have been because of the celebrations. The sky was regularly lit up with colour as fireworks rocketed up from the park, detonating high above the city. But as she drew nearer to it, she saw that it was something else. The smoke stretched up into the sky, a darkening pall against the dusk. She thought nothing of it until she drew close to Malate and she realised, with a sense of growing unease, that it was coming from the direction of the hotel. The traffic snarled up Welevariza Street, past to the east of the Zoological and Botanical Gardens. Pedestrians milled around, spilling into the road as they made their way to bars and restaurants and to the municipal celebrations in the park. Josie had no option but to stare impatiently as the finger of smoke slowly faded into the darkness of night. The traffic started to flow. She pulled off the street and into the parking lot, and saw that the manager's office was engulfed by flames. Oh, shit! A tender from the fire department was already on the scene. Firemen were arranged around the building, two of them attending to a hose that was directing a deluge of water over the flames. A crowd of men and women had gathered at the other end of the lot, kept away from the fire by the crew from the tender. Josie parked her car at the fringe of the crowd and stepped out. The heat from the blaze was intense, even at that distance.
"What happened?"
she called to one of the onlookers.
"I don't know,"
the man said, shouting to make himself heard above the angry crackle of the fire.
"I'm staying over there."
The man pointed back at one of the rooms.
"I saw smoke and then the flames. I called the fire department."
"Where are the owners?"
"I haven't seen anyone."
Fireworks boomed as they exploded overhead. Trailers of bright light fired out in all directions, and rockets whistled as they arched into the night sky. The smoke piled upwards, a column that reached for hundreds of feet. There was a call from one of the men aiming the hose, and then a hand signal directed back to the tender. The water pressure weakened and then stopped. Josie walked closer to the wrecked building. The fire looked like it was out, but the heat still radiated across the lot in thick, woozy waves. The windows had been shattered, and the tiles on the roof had collapsed into the building, the blackened joists naked to the sky. She caught the attention of one of the firemen.
"You got it under control?"
The man's face was covered in soot. He nodded.
"It's out."
"I'm Officer Hernandez," she said.
"Andrada,"
the man replied, wiping the sweat and grime out of his eyes.
"I'm the senior fire officer."
"What station?"
"Malate Volunteers."
"What happened?"
"One of the guests called it in. By the time we got here, it was out of control."
"Any idea what caused it?"
The man shook his head.
"Not yet. We have a look when the heat dies down."
She took out her phone, ready to call it in, and noticed that she had 10 missed calls. They were all from her mother. A huge rocket detonated, the echo of its explosion fading into the hiss and fizzle as it scattered red and blue sparkles over the city. Josie felt a sudden weakness in her knees. She tapped, trying to return the call, but nothing happened. She held it up again. The screen was blank. She had run out of battery. She turned and ran back to her car. Chapter 36. Josie drove south as fast as she could. Her mother lived on Summitville in a three-story building that had been converted into six compact apartments. It was not an expensive area of town. The street was home to a number of vendors who hawked food and drink from carts that they parked on the sidewalk. And there were always groups of customers, usually male, who gathered around them to eat and talk. The buildings were rickety, often in need of restoration, and the bright paints that had been used to decorate them had been bleached by the sun. Electricity cables buzzed and fizzed, and lines weighted down by wet washing crossed overhead. She parked and ran to the front door. She unlocked it and climbed the stairs. She unlocked the door to the apartment and tried to push it open. She couldn't. The security chain had been fastened. "Mama," she called, "it's me." She heard her mother's footsteps as she shuffled down the hall. The chain was disengaged and the door opened. "What's the matter, Mama?" Her mother looked frantic. She reached for her and drew her into an embrace. Josie looked over her shoulder and saw that one of the knives from the kitchen had been left on the table next to the telephone and the mail. "Mama, where have you been?" she said as she released her. "Where is Angelo?" "Asleep." "Where have you been? I left messages for you." "I'm sorry," Josie replied. "I have been at work and then my phone died. What's the matter?" Her mother went into the living room. Josie followed her to the coffee table. There was a plain envelope there. She handed it to Josie. The envelope had been opened and, as she upended it, a single bullet dropped into the palm of her hand. There was something else in the envelope too. She slid her fingers inside and pulled out a photograph. She recognised the building in the shot. It was Angelo's school. There was a group of children coming out of the gates and, her stomach plummeting, she saw her son staring across the road and into the lens. "Angelo," she said, hurrying for the bedroom door. "He is fine." Josie didn't stop. She carefully opened the door, pushing it open enough to look inside. Her son was in his bed, hugging his favourite teddy to his chest, the glow of his nightlight falling onto his upturned face. Josie exhaled. She felt a wave of relief so sudden and dizzying that she had to put out a hand to steady herself against the frame of the door. "He is fine," her mother repeated, drawing her back and pulling the door closed once more. Josie held up the envelope. "Where did you find this?"
"Underneath the door," her mother said, "2 hours ago."
"Did you see who it was?"
"No."
Josie went to the door, locked it, and then attached the security chain.
"There's something else,"
the old woman said, taking her daughter's elbow and taking her to the window. The blinds were drawn. "Outside," she said. "The car across the street." Josie parted the slats and looked out. It was dark, the illumination provided by the lights in the windows of the opposite building. There was a stall selling banana lumpias on the other side of the road, a line of empty tuk-tuk-style tricycles parked alongside it, with their drivers waiting to be served or bunched in groups together to talk.
"You see it? There. There."
Josie followed her mother's pointing finger and looked farther up the street. There were 7 tricycles. Behind the last one, parked up tight against it, was a black BMW with tinted windows. It was close enough to their building for whoever was inside to keep it under easy observation.
"It's been there for 2 hours," her mother said, There's a man inside it. I saw him go and get food from Gregorio.
Did you see what he looked like?
It's too far.
Anything, Mama.
Dark hair, I think. He was wearing a white jacket.
Stay here,
Josie said, heading for the door. What are you doing? Stay here, keep the door locked. She slid the security bolt, unlocked the door, and opened it. She was aware that her mother was at the door, but she ignored her and started down the stairs to the entrance. She undid the retaining clip of her holster and rested the heel of her right hand on the butt of her Glock. She stepped into the damp, muggy warmth of the night. The smell of the deep-fried banana and jackfruit was pungent, and the rowdy chatter of the tricycle drivers merged with the sound of the traffic on the busy road beyond the street to make a steady hum of noise. Gregorio looked up from his cart as Josie passed, but she did not stop. A fresh volley of fireworks erupted from the direction of San Guillermo Street, down by the bay. Josie closed her hand around the butt of the Glock and pulled, starting to free it from the holster. The BMW was 10 meters away. The tinted windows, together with the glare of the overhead street lamp that reflected off the glass, meant that she couldn't see inside. She was 5 meters away when she heard the engine growl into life. The headlamp sparked on, and she blinked into the sudden illumination. She took out the Glock with her right hand and held up her left, calling out for the driver to stop the car. The BMW did not stop. Instead, it pulled out into the street and sped in her direction, passing her with the squeal of rubber and the roar of high revs. Josie turned and watched as the car slowed for the junction, the taillights glowing for a moment before the driver released the brakes and stepped on the gas once more. The engine hummed and the car turned sharply to the right, quickly passing out of sight behind the corner. She glanced up and saw her mother's face looking down from the window of the apartment. She gripped the Glock a little tighter. Her palm was slick against the polymer butt, and she could feel the perspiration running down her back. She wasn't sweating because of the heat. It was a cold sweat. Mendoza? He had black hair, and he wore a linen jacket. Josie was frightened. She took the stairs two at a time and went back into the apartment. Her mother was waiting. She stared down at the Glock in Josie's hand. Pack a case, Josie said.
Why? What is it? What's the matter?
We have to leave. Chapter 37. Milton lay down and closed his eyes, but sleep did not come. His mind was restless, a flashing of emotions through the static of pain. There was relief. He had wondered whether he might have killed Jessica. At least he knew that he had not. And there was fear. Fitzroy de Lacy. He remembered. Milton had been given a file on de Lacy while he was serving in Group 15. He didn't remember exactly when it was, but it had been during the start of his descent into alcoholism. Those months and years had congealed into a vague mess, and it was difficult to peel them apart. He remembered receiving the file and being briefed by control. De Lacy had come to the attention of the spymasters in the River House, and Milton was to be the agent responsible for bringing him down. The intelligence had been excellent, and the report was voluminous. There had been a man, a member of De Lacy's inner circle, who had fled after his son had been murdered by another colleague. MI6 had been able to flip the man, promising him retribution for his son's death in exchange for his returning to the fold and providing his new paymasters with the information that they needed to bring De Lacy to justice. There had been a detailed portrait. De Lacy was around the same age as Milton, but the similarities ended there. He had enjoyed a privileged upbringing, the scion of an ancient family. He had been educated at Bryanston and then read law at Cambridge. He became Earl of Montgomery following the death of his father, Percy de Lacy, the 19th Earl of Montgomery. De Lacy began in the aviation industry in the mid-1990s.
He had moved to the United Arab Emirates to pursue his legal career and was seconded to the local offices of an air freight company that operated out of Dubai's international airport. He saw how much money the company was making, despite the fact that the management, which he despised, had no obvious business acumen. He quit his job and, leveraging some of the connections that he had made while working at the airport, he recruited a pilot and rented a Russian cargo plane. Tactical aviation was an immediate success, and within 6 months he had been able to recruit additional pilots and crew and had put together a small rented fleet of planes. He did business all around the world, with a focus on Africa. He transported agricultural equipment, domestic appliances, textiles and furniture from his base in Dubai to Benin, Botswana, Namibia, Rwanda, Senegal and the Congo. He developed contacts in Afghanistan, initially transporting Afghani textiles from Kabul, but quickly increasing the variety of goods that would ship. It was reported that he became close to elements within the government in Kabul. The Taliban was making advances from its redoubt in the south of the country, and the government was interested in resupplying its army with new weapons. De Lacy was approached by a source close to the Afghani president and asked whether he would be able to source and deliver a large amount of weapons. The profile had marked him down as a gambler and someone who was adept at thinking on the spot. He had no way to fulfill such an order, but he told the Afghanis that he could. He then set about finding a source who could provide the goods. He had previously done business with a businessman in Latvia. The man, Maris Gulbis, was comfortable operating in the grey area between legal and illegal trade. De Lacy flew to Riga to present him with a proposal. If Gulbis could source the weapons, he would transport them. They would share the profit equally. The Latvian black market was swamped with weapons from the former Soviet Union, and Gulbis put together a cargo that matched the Afghan request. The continued rise of the Taliban meant that the initial contract was renewed and then renewed again. The quantities doubled and then tripled. De Lacy stopped his business in legitimate freight and moved exclusively into running guns and other weapons. After 6 months, with business continuing to grow, Maris Gulbis was shot in the street outside his apartment in Riga. Local police had no leads and, after a cursory investigation, the case was closed. It was never proven, but off-the-record sources said that De Lacy had paid a corrupt police inspector to murder his associate and then shut down the investigation. Tactical ran into regulatory problems with the authorities in Dubai, and De Lacy transferred his business to South Africa. He found an airstrip that was suitable for his large Ilyushin IL-76 cargo planes in Polokwane, a city 200 miles to the northeast of Johannesburg. He set up an array of companies all around the world, many of them fronts through which he could funnel his burgeoning profits so as to minimize taxes and the ability of the authorities to investigate his activities. He had contracts with the Rwandan government to supply arms during the genocide. At the same time, another contract transported UN peacekeepers into the country. The soldiers who had travelled on his planes were attacked with the weapons that he had sold. He did deals with the corrupt regime in Liberia. He sold surface-to-air missiles to Hezbollah. He sold tank rounds to the Libyan regime. He supplied machine guns to the rebels in the Sierra Leone civil war. The Iglar missiles he supplied to rebels in Kenya were used to attack an Israeli airliner as it took off from Nairobi in 2002. He met with Hezbollah officials in Lebanon in the run-up to the 2006 war, and documents found in the wreckage of Muammar Gaddafi's former intelligence headquarters proved that De Lacy had a commercial presence in Libya and aimed to increase his dealings there. He was ruthless and amoral. A fresh contract supplied the Tutsi militias in Congo. Millions of civilians were massacred. If his complicity in their deaths preyed upon his conscience, it was not apparent. De Lacy bought a palatial retreat in the south of France. He filled the garage with supercars, commissioned his first yacht, and purchased a Gulfstream to take him to and from his business meetings. Tactical aviation grew, employing several hundred people and leasing nearly 50 planes. But his success brought him to the attention of the authorities. MI6 took an interest, and when he was described in the House of Commons as a merchant of death, following the discovery of a shipment of arms to the Tutsi militants, it was decided that something needed to be done. Discussions were undertaken in conference rooms in the Vauxhall Cross headquarters of MI6. Intelligence mandarins considered the benefits and disbenefits of de Lacy's continued activity. Chief among the latter was the fact that he was a British citizen and he was working against British policy in some of the most flammable areas of the world. A decision was made and a file was created. It was sent to the shabby building nearby that was the base for Group 15. The file was passed to Milton. Usually, those files spelt the imminent death of the men and women whose lives were laid out within those pages. But when it came to de Lacy, a different course of action was proposed. He would be taken out of circulation another way. Milton had found that curious, but it wasn't his place to ask questions. He was responsible for putting the plan into effect. De Lacy was to be set up and put in prison. Milton could hear the sound of Isco's light snoring as he slept. The man was close. Milton could have reached out and touched him without stretching his arm. He shifted, trying to find a position that didn't press up against the tender spots all over his body. It was impossible. The mattress was too thin, and he had bruises everywhere. He rolled over onto his back, folded his arms across his chest and looked up at the ceiling. The light in the cell was off, but the illumination from the lights outside meant that it wasn't close to being dark. He heard the sound of conversation from the nearby cells and, higher up, the sudden shrieking of a man in pain. Milton closed his eyes. He tried to think. He would need to be smart if he wanted to stay alive. He would need all of his experience. His thoughts slowed and, eventually, his mind became fogged with sleep. He saw Fitzroy de Lacy swimming in the sea as Milton watched from his yacht. Jessica was there too, lying on the deck in a bikini with a cocktail close at hand. She looked up at Milton and smiled. He allowed his breathing to deepen and, finally, he slept. Chapter 38. Josie didn't get much sleep. She woke from a light doze and fumbled for her watch on the nightstand next to her bed. It was 6:30. She blinked her eyes, slowly bringing them into focus, and saw her pistol on the nightstand too. It all came back to her. She wasn't in her own bed. She wasn't in her mother's apartment or even in Alabang. Last night had been awful. Her mother was stubborn and cantankerous, but she didn't demur when Josie told her that they had to leave. It was a family joke that Josie was slow to panic, and she must have seen her alarm and heard the urgency in her words. Both women had packed small cases, and then they had packed a third case with Angelo's things. Josie had woken her son, scrubbing the fright from her face as she told him that he needed to get dressed for an adventure that she and his Lola were going to take him on. He was too lost in sleep to protest and had fallen asleep on her mother's lap as Josie went outside to bring the car closer to the door of the apartment building. She had loaded the cases into the trunk and then she had waited for her mother to scoop Angelo into her arms. Josie led the way down the stairs with her Glock in her hand. She went outside first and waited anxiously while her mother carried her boy to the car and strapped him into his seat. They had driven north, continuing for 30 minutes until they reached Taguig. Josie pulled over outside the city and, using her mother's phone, found a suitable place to stay, calling ahead to ensure that they had a vacancy and that they would be able to check in after hours. The place was on Labau Street, and Josie had entered the address into her phone and followed the directions. It was called the Napindan Castle. It was a budget B&B, clean and tidy, and she had enough money in the bank to afford two rooms for a month or two. She scrubbed her eyes and turned over. Angelo was still asleep beside her, his breathing slow and even. The boy had been confused by the night's activities, but once they had settled into the room, he had very quickly burrowed against her and drifted back off into a carefree sleep. Josie wished that she might have done the same thing herself, but she couldn't. She remembered the fire at the hotel, the bullet with the picture of her boy, and the black car in the street outside the house. She had been given a message, and its meaning was clear. Her continued investigation into the death of the girl at the hotel had been noticed. She was being warned off. She lay back and closed her eyes, trying to maintain her composure. She needed to be rational. She had spent hours last night trying to work out who might have been responsible for the threats that she had received, and, as much as she tried to steer her thoughts in another direction, ultimately she could not. It had to be Bruno Mendoza. There was no question that he was involved. He had transferred Smith to Belibid. The owner of the bar had died the night after meeting him. Josie knew too much about him. She knew that he ran a death squad out of the station, a group of officers who prosecuted the president's war on drugs with a spree of extrajudicial executions. Killing the owner of the bar would have been a simple matter for him. He could have sent any one of his flunkies. The same could be said for the fire at the hotel. She doubted that he would have any compunction in doing away with her, too, if he decided that her investigation was dangerous to him. And he knew everything about her, that she had a son and where she lived. She had done the right thing in leaving and coming here. But now they were here, what next? She had given thought to calling in sick and staying off work, but she decided that that would not help her. She was never sick, and to be away from the station now would signal to Mendoza and anyone else involved in the conspiracy that she was frightened, and that might suggest that she had something to hide. No, she concluded once again. If she stayed away, she would be telling them that she had a reason to be fearful. She couldn't afford to do that. She needed to go to work. Chapter 39. Isco was already up when Milton awoke the next day. He heard the sounds of exertion and, as he opened his eyes and looked over at the old man's bedroll, he saw that he was working through a set of push-ups. He had taken off his shirt, and Milton could see his ribs, a corrugated pattern visible through his parchment-thin skin. Isco noticed that Milton was awake.
"Good morning,"
he said between push-ups. He performed another three to complete the set, dipping down so low that his chest touched the bedroll and then pushing up again.
"How did you sleep?"
"Not bad," Milton said.
"The noise did not wake you?"
"What noise?"
"There was a fight last night. Two men in the cell along from this one. I saw through the door. One of them was hurt. They took him out on a stretcher."
"Does that happen much?"
"It is not unusual,"
Isco said with a shrug that suggested it was mundane. The old man rose to his feet and put on his shirt. "What time is it?" Milton asked.
"A little after six. We will have breakfast soon. How do you feel?"
Milton assessed the damage. He had been hurt, but it was superficial. His bones appeared to be intact. His face was tender, and his body was sore from the kicks and punches that Tiny had delivered, but that was the extent of it. "Better than last night," he said.
"You look worse,"
the old man said, with a grin that exposed his disastrous teeth. Milton managed to get his feet beneath him and pressed himself upright. He winced from the effort as he slowly straightened his back. He heard a sudden clattering from the corridor.
"Rancho!"
came a shouted call. "What's going on?" Isco stood.
breakfast.
Milton heard the squeak of unoiled casters as the breakfast cart was wheeled down the corridor and the rattle of chains as the prisoners who were still restrained started to rouse themselves. The cart was attended to by a prisoner who, under the lazily watchful eye of a guard, deposited a bar of soap and a metal billy can of food for each inmate. There was a small opening at the bottom of the bars, and a second inmate slid the cans inside with dexterous flicks of his feet.
We're not going to the mess?
Not today. Sometimes they prefer to keep us in the cells. Not a bad thing for you, perhaps.
I'm not complaining, Milton said.
They slid the breakfast cans back out of the cell so that the inmates could collect them and stack them on the trolley as they made their way back along the corridor in the direction that they had arrived. Milton took a moment to close his eyes and think about the steps. He wished that he still had his copy of the big book. It had been left behind in the hotel room when he had been arrested. The book had accompanied him around the world. It was well thumbed, the pages turning to particularly familiar passages when he let it fall open. The margins were decorated with his annotations, and the text was garlanded with underlining and highlighted passages. He doubted whether he would ever see the book again. One of the guards walked down the corridor, shouting out a word that Milton did not understand.
What is he saying?
Exercise, Isco translated for him. We have an hour in the sunshine.
Chapter 40. The cell doors were unlocked and opened, and the men were allowed out into the corridor. They did not dawdle, immediately turning in the same direction and setting off. Isco waited for Milton to join him outside and then led the way.
You know anything about Bilibid?
Nothing.
They built it 80 years ago,
the old man explained as they descended the stairs to the ground floor lobby.
It was made for 2,000 men. In 20 years, they had 8,000. There was trouble, riots, murders. So they tore it down and built again. It made no difference. There are still many more men here than there should be. You will see.
The wall of the corridor was replaced by a wire screen that allowed them to look at a row of 8 cells, each sealed by iron bars. There were men inside the cells. There was no indication that their doors were to be unlocked. What have they done?
They are the Bitai, Isco explained. They have been convicted of crimes serious enough for them to be killed. They are kept here until it is time for their sentence to be served.
Death row?
Yes. They will be taken to the room where they have the machine that will kill them.
Isco put his index and middle fingers together and mimed an injection, his thumb serving as the plunger. They reached an antechamber similar to the one that Milton had been brought through on his way to the cell. Bright sunlight streamed inside, revealing a guard lounging back on a picnic chair with his billy club in his lap. He glared at them as they went outside. Milton felt the warmth of the sun on his face and immediately felt a little better. He looked up into the purest of blue skies, an infinite vault that was clear and cloudless for as far as he could see. The prisoners were corralled by a tall wire fence within a wide space. Guards with rifles patrolled outside the fence, and the two watchtowers that looked down on the yard were staffed by guards who stood at attention, unlike some of their colleagues. There would be no opportunity to escape today. Milton put the thought to the back of his mind. He would be watchful and take the chance to consider how the security functioned, but he would concentrate on enjoying the sun and the opportunity to stretch his legs. Men were circulating around the perimeter. Isco joined the flow and Milton followed. The old man turned and pointed back at the building.
The cell house is like a prison within the prison, he explained. We have 3 types of prisoner. The castigados, those who have been convicted of serious crime and who await death, and political prisoners like me,
What did you do?
I am a member of the Communist Party. I was convicted 15 years ago. I have been here ever since.
How long is your sentence?
For as long as they wish to keep me. He said, nothing has changed. My organization is still forbidden. They still see us as a threat to the country.
Do you have anyone on the outside? He shook his head sadly.
I had a wife. She was put in prison at the same time as me. She died 5 years ago. The last time I saw her was at our trial.
You couldn't appeal.
This is not like your England. Things are different here. You can appeal, but it would be a waste of time. A judge does not go against the regime. He would not be a judge for very long if he did.
The old man put a withered hand on Milton's arm.
It is all right. I have grown accustomed to my life here. I don't know what I would do if I was ever released. Time has moved on. I have been forgotten. There are people I know here. I have friends. Perhaps you will be another.
Milton was taken by Isco's sense of calm. He had seen it before in the meetings, the serenity that he, too, had sometimes found when he had accepted that he was helpless over his disease and there was no sense in pretending otherwise. They continued around the yard.
You said that Mr. Fitz set you up.
I think so, Milton said. I think he had a friend tell me a story that would make me come here. Arranged for me to be drugged, and then made it look like I was guilty of murder.
What will you do?
Milton glanced left and right. There were no other inmates or guards within earshot. I need to get out. Isco shook his head.
That will not be easy.
Has it happened before?
Yes, many times, but they don't last long. The government rebuilt this prison to be a symbol of law and order. It has a reputation that they wish to maintain. There was a man, a year ago. He managed to climb over the wall. There was a weakness at the back of building number 3, a blind spot where the guards couldn't see you from the tower. He climbed the wall with a rope and got away.
And then?
And then they hunted him down. They told us what happened to him. They had guards with dogs. They found him hiding in a ditch. They let the dogs have their way with him, and then they shot him. They showed us pictures. It was a warning. They were telling us that the same thing would happen to us if we tried to escape.
This blind spot, it has been fixed, Isco interrupted.
And John, please. You must think carefully. You are not a Filipino, and this is not Manila. There is jungle around the compound, and then there are villages where the locals would never have seen a man like you. You would stand out. They would call the police. They know that the regime would punish them if they did not.
Milton knew that Isco's concerns were well-founded. It would be difficult to escape on his own. He would need help. I need to deliver a message to a friend, he said. Isco shook his head.
I'm afraid that won't be easy either. You are new. If you're lucky, maybe they'll let you send letters when you have been here a few months. But they will open the letters and read them.
What about my lawyer?
Perhaps. But you will be fortunate if you can find one who will break prison rules for you. If they are found out, they would be punished. Perhaps they would join us here.
Milton frowned and looked down at the sandy surface of the exercise yard. It was baking, waves of lambent heat quivering as they rose into the air. He felt stymied. He knew that he couldn't stay here, but at the same time, it wasn't obvious how he could leave.
Your trial, perhaps, Isco suggested. That will be held in public. Perhaps that would be an opportunity for you to say something. Perhaps they will let you speak to your embassy.
Milton glanced over and saw a guard coming toward them.
Lou,
the man said, pointing his truncheon at Milton.
English.
Isco and Milton both stopped.
What's the matter?
Come here.
Do whatever they say, the old man said. I will see you later.
Milton walked the short distance across the yard to the guard.
Come with me.
Chapter 41. Milton was taken back to the latrines. He was thrown inside. The guards waited at the doorway, blocking his way out. It didn't matter. Where would he go? He heard the sound of feet approaching along the corridor. The guards parted, and Tiny made his way inside.
You again? Milton said, backing away to put a little space between them. You didn't get enough last time.
The big man grinned at Milton's bravado. Milton closed in and led with a right jab. His fist found its mark, glancing off the corner of Tiny's jaw, but it had a limited effect. Tiny tried to grapple him, but Milton was able to dance away to the right, ducking beneath the clumsy attempted bear hug and swinging a big left hook that terminated in the side of Tiny's temple. The punch hurt him. Tiny fell away to the side, his right hand reflexively going up to protect the point of impact and leaving his ribs exposed. Milton swung another left, putting all of his power into it, and his fists sank into the rolls of flab that protected the bigger man's ribs. Milton was caught up in the moment. He forgot that his future would not be best served by embarrassing Tiny, that he was guaranteeing a worse beating with every punch that he landed, and that they would take pleasure in ripping away every last shred of resistance. He surrendered to instinct and hammered a right-hander that detonated against the left side of Tiny's head. The big man staggered back, turning away from the open doorway and retreating to the other side of the room. Milton followed him, closing in quickly and drilling him with a right-left-right combination to the head, ribs, and head once again. Tiny ran out of room. He backed against the wall, both hands raised to protect the sides of his head, with a wide gap left open between his chubby forearms. Milton drew back his right fist until it was all the way back behind his head, felt the tension and power surge into his shoulder, and then released it, pummeling Tiny square in the face. The big man slumped back against the wall, his hands covering his face. Milton kicked him left and right, the side of his foot landing against his ribs and shoulders. Tiny began to slide down the wall, and Milton's kicks landed against his forearms. He heard an animal sound, an angry growling and panting, and realized that it was him. Tiny was down on his haunches, low enough for Milton to step in closer so that he could start to use his knees and shins. He cracked his right knee into the side of Tiny's head, then stepped back to switch legs when his vision went black, and his head was filled by a single high-pitched tone. He lost consciousness and, when he came round again, he found he was flat on his face on the floor. The concrete was cold and damp, and it smelt foul. He caught a quick glimpse to his side and saw one of the guards, his billy club raised above his head, and realized that he had been cold-cocked. The guard slammed the baton down, the wooden end cracking against his crown. The other guards came into the room, their own clubs raised. They rained blows down onto Milton, the ends of their clubs finding their marks as the men fell upon him. Milton tried to cover up, but they just switched their targets, hammering his trunk and then, as he rolled up, his kidneys. Milton curled into a ball, bringing his knees up to his chin, painfully aware that his back and ribs were vulnerable. He closed his eyes and gritted his teeth as the blows rained down on him again and again and again. Chapter 42. Milton became aware of hands on either side of his body. He was being gripped beneath his shoulders. He opened his eyes and looked straight down at the floor. It was moving beneath him. He looked down at pebbles and rocks, patches of sand, and then an uninterrupted run of rough paving slabs. His head hung limply, and his face felt like one huge throbbing bruise. His mouth was open, and streamers of saliva stretched down. He dabbed at the inside of his mouth with his tongue and tasted blood. He felt for his teeth. He thought that they were still there. A small mercy. He looked left and right and saw the legs of the men who were hauling him onwards. They were shod in shining leather boots. The guards. He allowed his head to dangle enough so that he could try to look behind him, but the effort made his head pound so that he felt like retching. He closed his eyes again. When he opened them again, he was back inside. He recognised the floor of the cell block, and his feet bounced off the stairs as he was carried upward. His cell door was open, and he was thrown inside. He landed on the floor between the two bedrolls.
"Hello again, John."
He looked up. Fitzroy de Lacy was standing before him. Milton didn't move. His body pulsed with pain.
"You still with us?"
"Hello, Fitz," he mumbled.
De Lacy laughed. Milton concentrated on what he could feel without having to open his eyes. His arms were splayed out, and, as he moved his fingers, he felt the imperfections in the concrete floor. He concentrated his attention on the multitude of individual aches and throbs that he could feel. His face was the worst. He was lying against something sharp, and it provided a pinprick of intensity that was just perceptible as a peak amid the general swelling. He allowed his attention to travel down his body. His ribs throbbed, as did several distinct areas on his back and legs.
"How are you feeling?"
Milton could feel the blood on his head, the warmth of it ebbing away as it started to clot.
"Not feeling so great," he said. "Sorry if I don't get up."
"They told me you took the fight to Tiny this time. How'd that work out for you?"
"I think I broke his nose," he said.
De Lacy chuckled again.
"You should have just taken your medicine. He wants to kill you now. I told him no. Don't want you checking out, old boy, not yet. He's going to be in charge of your morning exercise. I managed to placate him with that. He's looking forward to it."
Milton tried to roll over, but the effort was too much. He lay still.
"I had a cell like this when they first put me in here," De Lacy said.
"Bloody awful.
Can't really say anything good about it, can you? You've got a window, I suppose, but that just makes it worse, doesn't it? Seeing the sky, knowing you'll never see it as a free man."
Milton heard De Lacy's footsteps as he moved around the room, and then felt the toe of his boot against his tender ribs.
"You look pathetic, John.
Pathetic.
It's not how I remember you. You were something when we met before. You had a confidence about you. A swagger. I've been thinking about that. I always thought I was a good judge of character, but you put one over on me. Made me doubt myself. I keep coming back to it. How you were so confident. Arrogant. You knew I was dangerous, and you acted like it didn't bother you. As if you belonged with us. I believed every word of it. I'll be honest, old boy. It took me a while to get over how stupid you made me feel. But you don't look so confident now, John. All that cockiness is gone. You look weak."
Milton took a deep breath and felt a stabbing pain in his chest. He crawled ahead a few feet, pain flashing with the effort, and managed to fall onto his bedroll. He brought his knees up beneath his body and pressed up with his hands, raising himself enough so that he could turn and sit, his back up against the wall of the cell. He opened his eyes and looked over to where De Lacy was standing. He was wearing a pair of expensive-looking jeans, a white poplin shirt, and a pair of new desert boots.
"Going somewhere, Fitz?"
"Funny you should say that."
De Lacy undid his cuffs and rolled up his shirt sleeves. Milton saw a heavy and ostentatiously expensive watch on his wrist.
"As a matter of fact, I am. Leaving tomorrow. They've changed how they see me in London.
The new regime here has been fortunate for me too. I've been negotiating with them for years, obviously. The previous lot let me move into the villa and they let me run tactical, but they wouldn't release me. They didn't want to upset the Americans, apparently. But Duterte doesn't care about that. Wants the world to see him as a strong man. Doesn't want anyone to think the Americans can push him around. He's been much more receptive to what we've offered. The rest of my sentence is being commuted. Milton closed his eyes.
What did you have to put up for that?
What do you think? Think of the favours I'll be able to do once I'm in circulation again. You put me in here, John, but people haven't forgotten about me. Far from it. My old clients are very excited about the business we'll be able to do together, and I have new clients too. It's going to be a good year. He paused, chiding himself with a theatrical tut. I'm sorry. That was insensitive. It's going to be a good year for me. Not such a good one for you. De Lacy took a step toward the open cell door.
Fitz, Milton managed.
De Lacy stopped. Yes?
You said this would be the last time you saw me.
It will be.
No, Milton said. It won't.
De Lacy interrupted him with a chuckle. Oh, come on, John, he said. Do you know how ridiculous that sounds? He turned and took the step necessary to bring himself directly in front of Milton. He crouched down and put a hand on Milton's shoulder. Look at you. You're done, old boy. You're finished. Threats only work when they have substance. You can't threaten me. You're in here. I'll be out there. But when I say that you're going to be beaten every day, you should take that seriously. It's not an empty threat. And when I say you're going to die, you should believe that too. Fitz stood and backed out of the cell. Tiny stepped up and took his place. The big man had a dressing across his nose. He laced his fingers and pushed, cracking his knuckles.
More, Milton said.
Fitz smiled through the bars. Lots more. Have fun, John. Goodbye. Chapter 43.
Are you all right?
Milton coughed. He felt bubbles of hot blood in his mouth. His nose was clogged up with plugs of solid blood. He had to breathe through his mouth, and as he did, he felt stabs of pain from the back of his mouth. He probed with his tongue and felt the sharp sliver of enamel that had once been his back molar.
John?
He managed to groan. It was the best he could do. He felt Isco's hands as they slid beneath him, then heard him grunt as he tried to roll him onto the bedroll. Milton was in too much pain to help. His body throbbed, as if every last square inch had been pummeled repeatedly with a hammer. The pain swamped over him in waves. The old man persevered and managed to push him into a half roll that ended on the mattress. Milton lay still, face up, his eyes closed. There was more blood in his mouth and, lying like this, it started to trickle back into his throat. He managed to turn his head so that his mouth was pointing down and then tried to push the blood out with his tongue. He felt a dampness on his skin and then the sensation of something moving up and down in a gentle pattern. He opened his eyes. Isco was crouched next to him. He had poured the water from his mug onto Milton's forehead and now he was very carefully brushing it across his face with the tips of his fingers. The water was tepid, but his skin was burning hot and it felt good. The old man washed it over the cuts and bruises, gently brushing away the dried blood.
It was Mr. Fitz again.
Milton managed a moan.
And the big guy?
You were unconscious when I got here. He beat you worse than last time.
Milton wanted to tell Isco that he had embarrassed Tiny and that he didn't think it had gone down very well, but the sentence was too long